So I'm Rebecca Morley. I'm the director of the National Center for Healthy Housing. We're based in Columbia, Maryland. And we've got a great panel for you guys today. First, we're going to hear from Laura Enderico. She's in the School of Nursing and Health Studies at Georgetown University. And then you'll hear from NSAE about Witherspoon, who's the director of the Children's Environmental Health Network. And then finally, you'll hear from Denise Hernandez, who's the director of Green Communities for Enterprise Community Partners. And so I'm just going to be brief about their bios so that we can actually get right into the presentations. I think I got roped into this role by virtue of my work on the National Environmental Health Partnership Council. So I'm not Emma Din, in case that's what it says in the books. The Partnership Council is actually a collaboration or a network of national organizations that are working on raising up environmental health as a key issue. And part of that work has been looking at the value of environmental health. One project involves working with Frameworks Institute to reframe the issue of environmental health so it resonates better with the American public and with decision makers. And then another project that we've taken on just in the last year, and by we I mean Laura, is looking at the cost and benefits of environmental health and really digging through the literature to call what exists out there, and there's actually a lot. So we're really thankful for her work on that. I think all of us know that there's a fair amount of pressure these days to provide return on investment information or cost-benefit information for all of the environmental health programming that we're doing out there. And on one hand, I think that's great because we've got a good story to tell. And on the other hand, I feel personally a little bit cautious about this, that if every program and every service that we deliver has to be costed out, monetized, and justified, that it's a bit of a slippery slope, because some of the work that we do is difficult to monetize in that way. And also it's expensive to do, you know, with rigor, the kinds of evaluations that the funding community and others are expecting. So I guess I want to say that I'm glad that we have the kind of data that we do and that we're able to put it together in a thoughtful way. And then I also want us as practitioners to ask good questions when we're being asked for this data to find out what's the motivation, what's the underlying motivation, and are there other ways that we can provide the rational justification short of, you know, very expensive randomized control trials, et cetera. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Ms. Laura. So thanks, Laura.
And maybe at the discussion, you can talk a little bit about the report that came out from your organization this summer, right? Yeah. So I've got my phone here to keep me honest, and I tend to talk pretty quick, so I hope you had your coffee. So as Rebecca said, I was invited to become a member of the National Environmental Health Partnership Council last year, actually, at this time. Because I'm a professor and I have the benefit of having students who are always looking for opportunities to beef up their resume and to get their hands into actual work beyond the classroom, I volunteered to sort of dust off a project that had been started to look at the value of environmental health services. And I do have to say that originally we wanted to just look at return on investment, but as the process unfolded, we realized that we really needed to broaden the definition of value for sometimes those things that can't be measured. So hopefully that'll come through during this presentation. And I'm singing to the choir on this, but for many health professionals, when we talk about environment, they think four walls. They think workplace, school, home. The reality is it's everything that surrounds us, wherever we go and whatever we do. It sounds like a song. And in the best of days, we have sunshine and green and gentle breezes blowing through our hair. But also there are folks who never really get to experience that. And environmental health services at the local and state health department levels really helps us move towards a more just society with clean air, clean water, et cetera. As we began the process, we built on of this review of the literature to look at what's been studied so far, what data is out there. We wrestled with the obvious. How do we define environmental health, right? It's like public health. How do you define something that's so complex and so broad? We decided just to get in the boat and float with it and see what we could find and throw a wide net. As you might anticipate, some areas were well-researched and others were not. We also know that as much as 24% of global disease is caused by avoidable environmental exposures, and that the environment significantly affects more than 80% of major diseases. More than 33% of disease in children under the age of 5 is caused by environmental exposures. And we also know through the literature that there are a number of diseases linked to environmental exposures. Asthma, well-known exposures such as environmental tobacco smoke, air pollutants, mold, pesticides, and maybe those that are not as commonly known, such as endocrine disorders from DDT and perchlorate, cancer from solvents and pesticides. So we struggle with identity, right? Our environmental health services are getting defunded. We're having to do the same amount of work with less people, less money. And Americans really have a limited understanding of the critical work that's done by local and state environmental health programs. So we're continuing to manage, right, do the things that everybody expects, clean water, safe food. I have some very dear friends who are on the ground working every day as environmental sanitarians in Wisconsin, and it really breaks my heart sometimes the amount of work that they have to get done with a very limited budget and shrinking personnel. So, typical things, vector-borne disease, traditional environmental health issues, and now we have the emerging issues, many of them centering around climate change, disaster preparedness. If a city needs a cooling center, who gets called? Public health department. If we've got some intrusion into our water supply, who gets, you know, bacterial algae blooms, et cetera, who gets called? Public health department. And there's been, I think, an increased appreciation with public health with the Ebola, but, you know, these things kind of die down, and then we kind of go on as business as usual. As Rebecca said, the National Environmental Health Partnership Council brings together diverse groups of people and organizations to really help expand and sustain environmental health awareness, education policies, and practices. And so we meet several times a year. We look at some of the big issues around environmental health, and we felt that creating, not only doing a review of the literature, but creating a white paper would be an important first step. As a call to action. The American Public Health Association actually serves as a secretariat to support the council to gather us together, coordinate our efforts through a grant from CDC, National Center for Environmental Health, ATSCR. So the overall focus of this was really to look at value of environmental health as a branch of the public health system. And again, before I got onto the council, there was a health economist that came in and really talked about return on investment, cost-benefit analysis, what, you know, the do's and the don'ts and the gaps and the strengths of you know, proceeding with that viewpoint. As we continued to look at literature, it became really clear that we didn't want it just to be about return on investment. And quite frankly, there isn't that much data out there specifically related to return on investment. So it helped us round this out a bit. So it wasn't just all economics. We looked at the three primary environmental health services activities, including prevention, surveillance, and education. And again, we looked at this from an environmental health program stance. We decided after a lot of discussion that we would not focus on regulations and national policies, such as the Clean Air Act, that would follow this report. Because environmental health is so complex already, and then we started doing the policy piece and then the local program stuff, it became really very, very difficult to sort of tease it all out in a meaningful way. Bless you. So some of the challenges as we started looking at the literature and really thinking about environmental health and the story we wanted to tell was understanding and appreciating that a lot of the ROI or return on investment literature related to public health is pretty much a straight line. So what does it cost to provide an immunization? What are the benefits if we keep people from getting that disease? Pretty straight line. When we look at environmental health, it's not so easy, particularly when we look at people who live in different zip codes, different multiple exposures. It's not as narrowly defined. And so even though we are looking at, we do have some studies that have begun to look at cost-benefit, cost-effectiveness, return on investment, the range is not as narrow, and so there's all sorts of noise in the background that may or may not have been measured during that study. Another, or probably the biggest challenge when we try to estimate the benefits of a service is really what is that cause and effect, and how many modifiers between that intervention or service and outcome, how many modifiers get muddled up in between that, and are we actually measuring those? So I met with a health economist, formerly from RAND, who's now at Georgetown, to just get her perspective on some of the roadblocks we needed to really think about during this search. And most of these are actually pretty much direct quotes. She said that costing is the easy part. How much does it cost to have a person doing this work? But the thing that we rarely do in health sciences in particular is, is there an A and a B intervention, or is there just one intervention? Are we doing a comparative analysis? Are we just looking at the plain cost? I went to Betty Beckemeyer's presentation yesterday on public health practice-based research networks, and I can tell you that they don't even have fundamental data on cost in a lot of cases. It's just not collected. It's not anything health departments have actually done. And so even though costing is the easy part, it's not easy for us in public health because we're actually not consistently collecting it in a standardized way. Other cautions, don't jump to cost-benefit before you know that a program is effective. That's a whole other issue that, as we were going through articles, effectiveness may or may not have been studied. What's the causal association, and what are those anticipated benefits that we're hoping to see, short-term and long-range? And as I said earlier, there's so many degrees of freedom, so much noise in the background, that we have to be cautious then when we are reporting out our results on return on investment, et cetera, because we're probably not capturing everything we need to. So what were our methods for this particular white paper? Well, we decided after much discussion what topics we would search, and this kind of evolved over time. And as we were finding things or not finding documents and articles. We looked at air quality, we looked at climate change, and these are the breakdowns that we did for that particular topic. We originally had lead and mercury together, and we broke those apart. Water, foodborne illness, and healthy homes. We also had built environment, but there's nothing out there right now in regards to return on investment. This is a typical review of the literature. We have the author, how many people were in the study design, the indicators that were used, the health outcomes that we were hoping to see, and then in some cases it looked at cost and utilization outcomes, in other cases it was return on investment. And the cost and utilization outcomes were varied. So this makes it, again, difficult to do any comparison. Study may have used the cost of an illness that was prevented through an intervention, might have looked at quality-adjusted life years, loss of work or school days, number of hospitalizations, number of deaths, or reduced morbidity. We also had two areas that we originally had on our list, which was vulnerable populations, and we spent a good deal of time as a council talking about the best way to handle that. And we decided that for a number of reasons, First, there's not a whole lot of research done specifically for these populations through public health or environmental health services. But also we wanted to make a big statement about vulnerable populations up front in our introduction and background section. And so the two groups that we've included in that are children and environmental justice communities, and why they're particularly vulnerable and why environmental health services play a really important role when they work with these populations. So what did we find? Let me do a time check here. Okay. So the findings. We found in the professional literature, we found 79 publications. 22 of those looked at cost and burden of disease. 40 looked at cost-benefit or cost-effectiveness. 6 looked at just methodology and some of the challenges in doing cost-benefit analysis. 11 focused on return on investment, and this is for all the topics that I showed you in the first earlier slide. I then asked one of the students if she would be willing to look at the gray literature, which hadn't been done in the first phase of this. The council worked with the CDC librarians several years ago to get sort of a sense of what was out there. And there were 38 reports, and I would suspect that every day there's probably another new one. I do have some of the tables that the student put together if anyone's interested in looking at those. So I'm just going to take each topic and just highlight one study that we found. Some areas, you might imagine, foodborne illness had a lot of cost-benefit, return on investment type studies. Others did not. And so I pulled out some of the highlights of those studies. So when we look at water and water quality, this actually comes from the gray literature. Lompoc Valley did a leak detection and repair program, which avoided water supply costs and increased groundwater supply issues over the life of the project, which is anticipated to be 48 years. And they're looking at avoiding over $1 million in costs, which is pretty good. And that's local. On air quality, because we took out the policy and the regulation, the Clean Air Act and such, one of the very recent studies by Dave Jacobs and others looked at indoor air quality and found that for every dollar spent on asthma interventions, the health system saves anywhere from $5.30 to $14 per person. And that translates to actually billions of dollars. When we look at mercury, we know that from past research that cord blood mercury levels greater than 5.8 micrograms per liter is associated with a loss of IQ and economic productivity. In 2005, a study costed this out and found that it amounts to about $8.7 billion annually if we don't avoid or reduce those exposures. I'm going to do a little commercial here. There's a comment period right now. It's been very quiet. The EPA and FDA is putting out a brand new joint statement about encouraging pregnant women and children to eat more fish. And if you care about methylmercury and you care about kids, I'm happy to give you the link. This is being, there are folks in EPA that don't even know this is happening. And they have a group of health communicators on this special committee to try to market people to eat more fish because fish consumption for kids and women have dropped because of public health intervention, getting the word out. Sorry, I just had to say that. Focus on foodborne illness. A study done recently by Hoffman in 2012 found that 14 of the 31 major foodborne pathogens account for an average of $14 billion in cost of illness and a loss of 61,000 quality-adjusted life years per year. That's pretty substantial. On climate change, Pennsylvania did a heat wave program for people 65 and over. They created an alert system to let seniors know about heat waves, and they also created cooling centers and community health workers that would go out and shuttle seniors to these cooling centers. There was a $468 million gross benefit as a result of that program. Healthy Homes, and I hope Rebecca talks a little bit about her, the report from her organization. Dixon et al. In 2012 found that 12 years after window replacement intervention, homes had 41% lower interior floor dust lead in comparison to homes without replaced windows, and that the net economic benefit of window replacement is $1,700 to $2,000 per housing unit. And lead, which has been studied pretty well, Gould et al. Found that lead remediation, each dollar invested in this program, these kinds of programs, and lead paint hazard control results in a return of investment of $17 to $221 per household, or a net savings of $181 to $269 billion. So, gaps and strengths, what did we find? There's a lot of gaps. We've really got to, I'm glad that we're doing this call for action in this white paper, because it will have some very specific recommendations for future research, standardizing, so that across the country programs can get the credit where credit is due, and we can really continue to build the science and the evidence behind the good work that's being done. It's critical that environmental health services be viewed as absolute necessities for ensuring the health and safety of our citizens. Looking forward, we're going to have the white paper done in January, I'd say early January. There are cards in the back. If you want a copy of that, we'll be happy to send that to you. We will also be rolling the white paper into a journal and a professional publication, peer-reviewed. We're also looking at Healthy People 2020 and CDC's preventive community preventive guidelines to see if we can beef up the environmental health language within those documents as well. Thank you.